This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Bismillah, alhamdulillah, wassalatu wassalamu ala rasulillahi wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa min wala rabbi shahli sadri yusirli amri wa ahlul uqdatan min lisani yafqahu qawli. So inshallah, before I start, just reminded me to plug, inshallah, we have a fundraising dinner on Friday. Imam Tom Fakini from the US, inshallah, is joining us, so you're able to purchase a ticket and come to support, inshallah. We really need the support. We've sold like very few tickets, so inshallah, any support will be appreciated, bismillah. Tayyib, inshallah. So we spoke last week about the first of the qawa'id, al-yaqeen la yazulu bil-shak. And we spoke last week about al-mur bi-maqasidiha. Yeah. And today, inshallah, we'll speak about the second of the five major qawa'id, major legal maxims. And there are many rules and many laws in Islam that are connected to this. In order to understand this statement, to understand this legal maxim, al-yaqeen, certainty, la yazul, is not displaced by shak, by doubt. To understand this, we have to understand two things first. What is yaqeen and what is shak? Right? So, yaqeen is al-a'tiqad al-jazm, belief. So a belief that you assert, something that is known, that you believe in, that you believe to be true. That is yaqeen. Shak, doubt, with the scholars of fiqh, with the fuqaha, and you have to write with the fuqaha, is mahal al-irtida. It is the place of hesitancy. Any hesitancy, the absolution of hesitancy, in the views of the scholars of fiqh, is considered shak, is considered doubt. So, if we have two options, or if I tell you is whatever it is we're talking about, is it true or false? And in your mind, 50% it might be true, 50% it might be false. To you, the possibilities are equal. The scholars of fiqh will call this shak. This is doubt. Okay. What if I ask you, is it true or false? And you say, I think 30% chance it might be true, and I think 70% chance it's false. So I think 30% is true, most likely it's false, but maybe it's true. This is also shak with the scholars of fiqh. And what if you said, again, what if we said it's 80%, I think it's true. And 20% chance it's wrong, but 80% I think it's true. With the scholars of fiqh, again, this is shak. So all of these are shak. With the scholars of usul, this is not what they say. With the scholars of usul, they say, if one is rajih, is more likely, outweighs the other. So if one of them is 80%, then the 80% is called dhan. Dhan is something you assume or something you think. This is dhan. And al-marjuh, the thing that is less likely, that is 20%, 30%, you think it might be true. They call this wahm. And if something is 50% true, 50% false, they call this, who can tell me? Shak, exactly. So, anything less than 100% for the scholars of fiqh, for the fuqaha, is considered shak. But for the scholars of usul, if it's more likely, it's dhan. If it's equal probability, it is shak. And if it is less likely, it is wahm. And this was stated by Imam an-Nawawi in his Sharh Sahih Muslim. It's mentioned by Imam Buhati as well. and Kashaf al-Qina', which is an important book for the Hanbalis. Ibn Qayyim mentions this as well. The differentiation between the word shak with the scholars of fiqh and between the scholars of usul. And based on this, if you open a book of fiqh, and in the book of fiqh it says, whoever is certain of their tahara, of their purity, and they have shak, they have doubt about their hadath, their impurity, they should act upon the certainty. How do we understand this shak? According to the definition of the fuqaha or the definition of the usuliyun? The fuqaha, because it's a book of fiqh, right? And this is important because it's a very common mistake. Some people will read the definition of shak from the usuliyun, then they come to the books of fiqh and they are using that language, that definition, in the books of fiqh. And this is a big mistake, right? We conflate between these two meanings. And you're interpreting the words of one people by the meaning of another people. And that's a mistake that people make. That's very important to understand that difference. So now, based on this that we've all talked about right now, yes? So if it is more likely to be true, they call that dhan. And if it's less likely to be true, they call it waham. Waham. So based on all that we've said right now, whoever is certain that they made wudu, and then for Salat al-Isha right now, you're certain you made wudu, and then before you pray, all of a sudden you start to doubt, am I impure or not? And he thinks, maybe there's a 30% chance I'm impure. What do we tell him? Does he assume he's in a state of purity or not? Huh? Are we?
We were
taking on surah. So if he's certain he made wudu and then he has doubt, did I break my wudu or not? We tell him to stick with his wudu. And if he was 50-50, or if he said 80% chance I broke my wudu, do we tell him to continue to pray, or do we tell him go and make wudu? Which one? Continue to pray. Because we say stick to the yaqeen. Because in the eyes of the fuqaha, anything less than 100% is shak. In the eyes of the fuqaha, anything less than 100% is considered shak. Now, is it possible? Yes.
Sorry. So for this qawaid that we're talking about, we're taking the meaning of the fuqaha.
Yes.
So basically, any percentage less than 100 is...
Any percentage less than 100 is considered doubt. Okay, so now based on everything we said, is it possible for yaqeen to be displaced by dhan, by assumption, by more than 50% probability? Do we displace it? No. And because of this, some of the scholars have another qa'idah, they have another legal maxim, مَا ثَبَتَ بِيَقِينَ لَا يَرْتَفِعْ إِلَّا بِيَقِينَ. What is established by yaqeen is not removed except by yaqeen. Right? So this is another way of saying it. That if we are certain of something, it does not get removed unless we're certain by something else. So if I'm certain I made wudu, it does that, it never changes until I'm certain that I don't have my wudu. Okay. Remember we spoke, I think, a couple of classes ago, about a man who doubts whether he divorced his wife or not. So he comes and he says, you know, I was really angry and, you know, we're having an argument. I don't remember if I told her she's divorced or not. We go based on what? We go based on what is certain. So he's certain he's married to her. He's unsure if he divorced her. Even if he's 90% sure, even if he says, you know what, Sheikh, I think I probably did say it. I probably did tell her she's divorced, but I don't remember. We say, doesn't matter. You remain married to her until you are sure that you divorced her. So the definition of this qa'ida is that if a person has an assertion in his heart that something is proven, or that something is absent, he's sure that something exists or something does not exist, then he has no right to abandon this due to the existence of something that emerges or is suggested to him. Rather, he should act according to the original certainty, and he should not give regard to an emergent doubt. Yes. This qa'id, no, all of them agree. This is one of the major qawaid. No. Okay. So this qa'ida only applies to matters, we should say, and this is a very important point. You want to write this down. This qa'ida only applies to what we say, al-ahkam al-talabiyya al-fiqhiyya. Actions of jurisprudence, fiqhi issues, basically. And it does not apply to matters that are khabariyya, matters of creed or belief or anything like that. What do we mean by that? Right now, if we ask, does Allah exist? Everyone says yes, okay. Are you certain that Allah exists?
Yes.
100% certain, okay. If someone has doubt about this, not a passing thought, Shaitan whispering something here, but like doubts about this. He says, I'm doubtful, I don't know if Allah exists or not. Do we say, al-yaqeen la yazulu bishak? No, we say, al-yaqeen zalat bishak, right? This yaqeen has been removed by his doubt. He doesn't have iman anymore, right? His belief in Allah's existence is gone, right? So, this is only for issues that are talabiyya, issues related to commandments, related to orders, related to fiqh, right? So you're asked to pray, you don't know, did I break my wudu or not? These are fiqhi issues, issues of commandment. We hold on to the certainty and we ignore all that is doubtful. And this is the meaning of this legal maxim. From the proofs of this, the evidences of this, and of course there are many, many in the Quran and mostly in the hadith that we can rely upon, a few clear ones. The Prophet ﷺ said, if any of you has a pain in his stomach and he is doubtful as to whether anything has come from him, meaning if he has passed gas, then he should not leave the masjid until he hears a sound, حتى يسمع صوتا أو يجد ريحا, until he hears a sound or perceives a smell. And the scholars talk about this hadith. They say, when the Prophet says until he hears a sound or he smells a smell, is not literal. Meaning the Prophet is not saying only leave if you hear the sound or if you smell it. What the Prophet is saying is leave when you are certain. Right? So if you're not sure, and the only thing that establishes your certainty is the sound or the smell, then once you're certain, leave. But if you are certain and you didn't smell anything, or you didn't, but you're certain that happened, then you also have to leave, right? So that point of this hadith, they're saying, is not meant to be literal. What the point of the hadith is, don't leave the prayer, don't leave the masjid until you are certain. When you are certain you broke your wudu, then leave in that scenario. And so he can't leave the yaqeen that exists until another yaqeen comes. And this is a very, very powerful protection, by the way, against waswasa, right? It's a very powerful protection that sometimes we start to wonder, am I on my wudu or not? Am I certain I made wudu or not? And so we always go to this is an easy rule. What are you certain of? Are you certain you broke it or are you certain you have it? You're certain you made wudu, then khalas. You don't turn to anything until you're certain that you broke it. And the opposite is true as well. And so Ibn Rajab, rahimahullah, he says, whoever is certain of purity or impurity in the body, or in the earth, or upon their clothing, is doubtful that the state has been removed. So you're certain of impurity and you're uncertain it's changed. Or you're certain of impurity and you're uncertain it changed, whatever the case is. فَيَبْنِي عَلَى الْأَصْلِ He should build based upon the original state. He should act based upon the original state. Until he is sure that it has changed. And he says, and غالبت الظن, the high probability is not enough, neither is anything else. So now it shows you very clearly that when the scholars say shak, they mean any type of hesitancy. It doesn't matter if it's a small amount or if it's غالبت الظن. You're 95% sure this happened. 99% sure. It doesn't matter. You have to be completely sure. You have to have complete certainty. Yaqeen does not get displaced except with another yaqeen. Also, the hadith of our Prophet ﷺ, he said, if any of you is in doubt over his salah, إِذَا شَكَّ أَحَدُكُمْ فِي صَلَاتِهِ فَلَمْ يَدْرِي كَمْ صَلَّى. He's not sure how many rak'ahs has he prayed, three or four. The Prophet says, let him cast aside his doubt and base his prayer on what he is sure of. So I'm not sure, did I pray three rak'ahs or four? I'm sure I prayed three. I'm not sure if I prayed the fourth. So I go with three and I cast aside my doubt. And so based on what we have said, if we have yaqeen, we do not turn towards dhan, because dhan is a form of shak. However, oops, how do I go back? However, we say that, so based on what we've said, if you have yaqeen, you do not ever turn towards dhan, because dhan is a form of shak. But there are some areas in which the fuqaha did rely upon dhan, did act upon dhan. So I'll give you an example. Let's say you're in a Muslim country, you're in a village somewhere, and you're sitting and talking, and then the muadhin gives the adhan. It's the time for asr prayer. And in principle, we are in the daytime. Or let's say it's asr and he makes the adhan for maghrib, for example. And the principle is that we're in the daytime, right? And the night does not become established except with evidence. We're sitting outside, we haven't seen the sunset, but we hear the muadhin give the adhan. We heard one person give the adhan, right? Is it permissible for us to pray on that adhan or not? No? So, we do pray, because the Prophet ﷺ told us to pray when we hear the adhan, okay? However, the adhan of that one person, is it yaqeen or is it dhan? Because it's a testimony of one person. It's not qat'i, it's not yaqeeni, it's dhan. It's possible one person made a mistake. However, we are doing what the Sharia has told us to do. So the Sharia tells us when we hear the muadhin make the adhan, we pray. Because we start with a principle that the muadhin is ameen, the muadhin is trustworthy. We have that starting principle. Okay, I'll give you another example. We'll pick on Zayd, like we always do. Okay, Zayd is innocent, right? Of murder, he's innocent of theft. Whoever the person is. Should I pick on someone? Should I pick on Muhammad? Okay. Muhammad is innocent of murder and theft, correct? Do we know this from yaqeen or do we know this from dhan? When we say that he's innocent, that he has the presumption of innocence. We're assuming it? No. We say it's yaqeen. Why do we say it's yaqeen? Because we know he entered the world and he wasn't a murderer, he wasn't a thief. We know at the beginning, he was not a murderer, a thief. Okay? So based on that yaqeen, we're continuing. Right? So if we say, what is the establishment of him being innocent? We say the establishment is yaqeen. Okay. Now two trustworthy witnesses, the two brothers here, come forward. And they say, we saw Muhammad kill someone. And they go to the judge. And they say, we saw the murder, and et cetera, et cetera. Or they say, we saw him steal, and he was stealing from something that was protected. And he stole a great amount of money. And they go to the judge, and the judge says, okay, you two are trustworthy. And you have both given me your witness. So now we have to punish Muhammad. Okay. What is yaqeen? His original innocence or his culpability? Or the claim of the two witnesses? Which one is yaqeen? The claim?
Because as long as they have like evidence to back it up.
Isn't it possible that the two of you are lying? Even if we know you to be trustworthy, isn't it possible the two of you are lying? It's possible. So technically, your testimony is dhann, and his innocence is yaqeen, and yet the judge will still punish him. You thought you were getting away. Why is this the case? Why? It's simple. Because there's a hukm shar'i. Because there's an Islamic ruling on this matter. The Islamic ruling is that if two witnesses come forward and they are trustworthy, then this is enough for the punishment. Right? So because of... Sorry? Yeah. Exactly. And he can look at these two people. If he knows that they're, if it's established they're trustworthy, nobody can say that they're liars, and then he has to take their testimony. The point is, he is acting upon the dhann over the yaqeen. And we say this happens because this is hukm shar'i. Right? And it makes sense, obviously, if we said that the testimony of witnesses is not going to be accepted because it is possible they are lying, then nobody will ever be punished for murder, for theft, or anything like that. Because we're always going to, you know, have the claims that are made are always going to have some fun, right? So these are some issues in fiqh in which we may act upon dhann. So if there is a hujjah, if there is a evidence, like the testimony for hudud, or the sunset for a fasting person, so the scholars say, if someone is fasting, and they have ghalabati dhann, high probability in their minds that the sun has set, it's Maghrib. So they're 90% sure that it's Maghrib. Can they break their fast? The fuqaha will say they can break their fast, but it is better to wait until they have yaqeen. But it is permissible for them. So the sunset for the fasting person, this is an example. There's a few other examples as well. I don't know the reasoning, to be honest, but this is an area of where they give precedence to ghalabat al-dhann over yaqeen.
Does this also apply to
I don't think so. That's my knowledge. Yeah. That is dhann, technically, yeah.
But we still act upon it.
We act upon it.
The yaqeen is we're still in
Masha'a. So.
But the dhann is the witness is saying we're still taking it.
Yeah, that's true.
Has
to see it. Absolutely. Yeah, you're right, actually. That is an example. Okay, where do we not act upon dhann? Like we mentioned, wudu and tahara. So somebody doubts their wudu, doubts their tahara, we don't act upon their assumption. Somebody who doubts or assumes maybe he divorced his wife, you know, I was really angry, I didn't know what I was saying. Again, we don't use ghalabat al-dhann here. So man shakka في طهارة أو طلاق أو or the rak'at they have prayed, if they have shak in any of this, or the number of times they've gone around the Kaaba during their tawaf, or the number of times they've breastfed a baby, all of these, we go with the lesser, with what we are certain when we have doubt. Okay, there are a number of sub-maxims related to this one, yes.
So I'm sorry, a little bit in, going back a bit. For the usuli definition, when is that definition an actual one? In what context is that definition? Why do they have that definition?
So in areas of usul, it will come up.
Yeah. Like who derived from the ruling?
Yeah.
Okay, so now when you're like giving the ruling, but deriving the ruling.
Deriving the ruling, they will use that.
About evidence, basically.
Yeah.
Whether the evidence is still there.
And like we said, there are some areas of fiqh where we will use dhann. And so in that case, we will be looking, for instance, they will say you can act upon dhann or you can act upon ghalabat al-dhann, right? So then these are usuli definitions now, right? Okay, the first principle, al-aslu baqa ma kan ala ma kan. The principle is that things remain as they were. And many scholars consider this qa'ida to be synonymous with the previous one, al-yaqeen la yazulu bishak, because they are very similar. And some of these are, in fact, very similar to each other. Things remain as they have been established to be unless we are certain of change. This is what this means. So you made wudu for Maghrib, this is established. Aisha prayer comes, you doubt your wudu. We say in principle things remain as they were. So nothing has changed. Likewise, for example, somebody, we established that somebody took a loan for $1,000. So let's say we established that I took a loan from Muhammad for $1,000. Then I claim that I returned the $1,000, but I don't have any proof. Whose statement is taken? Mine or his? His. Why?
Because you know that he knows that you borrowed the money.
Because we established that I borrowed the money. We have not established anything beyond that. Because there's no proof. I don't have proof, he doesn't have proof, there's no proof that exists. So things remain as they were. So they remain that I borrowed. Okay. Al-aslu bara'atil dhimma. This is the second one, that the presumption of innocence or the principle of innocence. So bara' means innocence. Dhimma is, and this is a definition, if you want to write it, the description that comes upon a mukallaf. So the description that comes upon a responsible person that makes them party to obligation or commitment. So the Arabs will say if somebody broke their vow, if there's a vow between them or a treaty between them and someone breaks it, they say نَقَدَ ثِمَّتُهُ, his dhimma has fallen. Or if somebody's insane, then they say لَا ذِمَّةَ لَهُ, he has no dhimma. So dhimma is a description that this is a person who can be obliged, can commit, just like you cannot oblige somebody who doesn't have their mind faculty, he doesn't have dhimma. And you cannot oblige somebody who breaks the treaty with you. If you have peace with them and they break the treaty, you can't oblige them, you can't expect them to do anything, right? So this is the dhimma. So the human being should have a dhimma, has a dhimma. And we assume their dhimma is innocent, essentially. So the meaning of this is that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala created us innocent, and we break the dhimma if we commit murder or theft or drinking alcohol or whatever. But in principle, the person is innocent. So say some person accuses another of theft or of stealing or of murder or whatever it might be. We say the principle is we assume that they are innocent. And who needs to bring the evidence in this scenario? The accuser, right? The one who's making the claim. So for example, yes?
I was wondering, when you mentioned the example of borrowing $5,000.
Yeah.
So like in a court, for example,
yeah.
Let's say you did return your $5,000, but you had no proof.
Yeah.
Would you still be obliged to pay back the $5,000, right?
Yeah. Because from the you're looking at it from the judge's perspective, right? So from the judge's perspective, you're going to say, there's no evidence. I have to stick with what's established, which is that a loan was made.
But if it's, let's say, like, in people,
yeah.
One person says, like, I return the money to you, and he says, let's say,
yeah, he did return it. Yeah. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala knows, and the person who's lying is sinful. But we're looking at it from the perspective of a jurist, of a judge, right? So the judge is going to make decisions based on what has been established with evidence. Okay.
In this case, if
so what this means is Bira'atul Dhimma, what it's meaning, like this is not from a like tazkiyah perspective, if I do Umrah, can I be forgiven for my sins, etc. What this means is we assume that the person is innocent unless it's been proven to be broken. right? Unless this dhimma has been proven to be broken. That's all this qawaida means, right? So of course, if someone commits evil and they make tawbah and they turn to Allah Azza wa Jal, Allah can forgive them. But that's not the point of this. The point of this is, do we assume from the beginning that a person is innocent, or do we assume from the beginning that they are wrongdoing? We assume the innocence. So an example, if a person says, like a similar example, if we say like I took $1,000, someone took $1,000 from me, who has to bring the evidence? So the one making the accusation. So if I say you took $1,000 from me, and we stand in front of the judge, I'm making the accusation that you took $1,000 from me. I have to prove it, right? And if you reject it, all you have to do is swear a testimony that you did not take it. Okay, so what if in a case, let's say Muhammad says that I took $10,000 from him, and I say no, I only took $5,000 from him, and there's no evidence for me and there's no evidence for him, what's the ruling here? The ruling is the $5,000. Why? Because we both agreed that at least 5,000 was taken. He's saying 10,000, I'm saying it was only 5,000, but we've both agreed that at least 5,000 was taken. So it'll be the 5,000 will be agreed upon, and the other 5,000 will not be acknowledged. Yeah. Okay, let's say someone comes and says, there was an issue and I swore an oath. Sorry, there was an issue and I don't remember if I swore an oath or not. Maybe, I think I swore an oath to Allah, but I don't remember if I did. Does he have to do a kafara or not? No, because we assume, in principle, his dhimma is innocent. So even innocent of swearing an oath, right? Okay, the next qa'ida, al-asl fil umur al-arida al-adam. The principle in the emergent or the incidental matters is non-existence. And this too is pretty similar to the previous qa'ida as well. And the meaning here is that the principle in attributes that are arida, that are emergent or new, we assume its non-existence. And oppositely, the scholars will say that the principle in the attributes that exist, originally exist, is that we assume their existence. So what do we mean by that? Someone has taken a loan. We established the loan has been taken. Now he claims, I paid back the loan. What is it that exists and what is it that is emergent? What's new that's being offered and what already exists? So the new part is the claim he returned the loan, and the existence is the loan itself, because we said we established the loan. So what is new, the principle of it, is that it does not exist. It's non-existence. And he has to prove that it in fact exists. And so many examples of this, a woman doubts, did I breastfeed this baby or not? So we say the principle is al-adam, it didn't happen. A man divorces his wife and then he says, I don't remember if during the iddah I took her back or not. Somebody came to me and told me you should take her back and et cetera, et cetera. And I don't remember in that time if I said, okay, fine, I take her back or not. So what do we say to this person?
That you haven't taken her back?
Sure? Are you certain?
I'm not certain. Yeah.
The same? So what is established and what is new? Divorce is established. And the arida, the emergent issue, the incidental issue is, did he take her back? And so we say the principle is that the new issue doesn't exist. So it doesn't exist until we can establish it. Okay, the next one. Al-Asl idafat al-hadith li aqrab al-awqat. This is a very good one. It's very useful to know this one. The principle is to place the event at the nearest time. Okay, so in the previous examples we said you're doubtful of the existence of the hadath, of the impurity. Now let's say you are certain of the hadath, you're certain of the impurity, you're uncertain of the time. So I'll give you an example. You made wudu, you prayed Isha, and then you went to sleep. And then you woke up and you prayed Fajr, and then you went to sleep. And then you woke up and you prayed Dhuhr. Hopefully you don't sleep this time. And after you prayed Dhuhr, you went into the washroom and you looked on your body, on your clothes, and you see the signs of Janaba, right? So an impurity happened for sure. Are we uncertain about the impurity? We're certain because we've seen the signs of it. What are we not sure about? When did it happen? And what prayers does he have to redo? Okay? So now, he's certain it didn't happen when he was awake. It must have happened when he was sleeping, correct? But now when did it happen? Did it happen when he slept at night? Or did it happen when he slept in the morning? That's the question. In the morning? What's your evidence? Why do we assume this? Yeah. Okay. So if we said we're placing it at the earliest time, then the earliest time would be right after he prayed Isha, right? And in which case he has to redo Fajr and Dhuhr. And if we said it happens at the nearest time, then we say all he has to redo is Dhuhr. Okay? So what's the solution? Like we said, this qa'idah says we place it at the nearest time. Why is this the case? And you can think about this from the previous qawa'id we already talked about. What are we sure 100% he prayed and he was in a state of tahara? Aisha. What are we sure 100% he prayed and he was in a state of janaba? Dhuhr. What are we in shak about? Fajr. So we say, al-yaqeen la yazulu bishak. So the fajr is fine, he just has to redo the dhuhr, right? Okay, I'll give you another example as well. A Muslim marries a Christian woman. Okay, we're not talking about in Canada and all these issues, but you know, assume somebody is in the Muslim world even a long time ago, for example, he marries a Christian woman. And let's say, for example, he has two wives. He has a Muslim wife and he has a Christian wife. And he has children from the Muslim wife. And so Muslim children. Now, this woman accepts Islam, the Christian woman accepts Islam, and the husband dies. If she accepts Islam before he dies, does she inherit from him? Yes. If she accepts Islam after he dies, does she inherit from him? No. Okay. So now imagine he dies, and the woman comes forward and she says, I accepted Islam before he died. Now what is her benefit? What does she benefit from if she says this? She inherits. And the children come forward and they say, no, she's lying. She only accepted Islam after he died. What do they benefit from this? Nothing? They get more money because she doesn't inherit. Okay, so each of them have something to gain. We tell both of them, bring your proof. Right? They say she didn't accept, and she says, the only Muslims I know are these children. And they are my opponents, they're against me. So what is the principle regarding this woman? She didn't accept Islam. Why? So we're doubtful about before she died, yeah.
This principle
Exactly.
The closest time is after.
Exactly. So the closest time, the nearest time we can place it, is after he's died. As well, you can say it's established that she is not a Muslim, and the emergent issue is the claim that she is a Muslim, right? And so this is the new event. But we place it at the nearest of times, which means after the death of the husband. And so the hukum shara'i is she does not inherit. But of course we go to the kids and we tell them, this is, you know, your father's wife and you should be good to her and she's accepted Islam now and give her something. And, you know, we try to tell them to be good. But from a point perspective of what is the hukum, what is the ruling? The ruling is she does not have any right unless she can prove that she accepted Islam before his death. Okay, the next one. الأصل في الأشياء الإباحة. The principle in all things is permissibility. And things are permissibility. In this qa'id, I'm sure many of you have heard this one before. When we say الأشياء, the things, what does this actually mean? This means, the scholars say, the things that bring benefit. The things that bring benefit. So, do we have evidence that this microphone is halal? Is there something in the Quran and Sunnah about microphones? No. But the principle is that it's permissible and this is something that benefits. Right? So, and this is important because what if somebody comes, here's a new food, a newly discovered food, and we establish that it's poisonous, it's cancerous, it's deeply harmful, and it's a new thing. And it's not mentioned in the Quran and Sunnah. Do we say the principle in all things is permissibility? No, because what is meant by all things is all things that benefit. If we can establish clearly that this is not beneficial and this is harmful, then it doesn't fall into this rule. So this statement, الأصل في الأشياء الإباحة, it is عام يريد بها خاص. It's intending a specific meaning. The specific meaning is things that are beneficial. So all types of, you know, electronic gadgets and whatever, the principle is that they are permissible. And for animals, as for animals, the principle also is permissibility. Except that which the Sharia has made exception for. So for instance, the Sharia says you cannot eat an animal that has fangs. You cannot eat an animal that has claws. You cannot eat a bird that has talons. And of course the pigs, and of course the dead animals. So everything excluded from this, the principle is permissibility. So the Arabs didn't know what a giraffe is. Giraffes are in Africa, parts of Africa, usually South Africa, that area. The Arabs didn't know what it was. They came and they found it, and they wrote in some of the books of fiqh, it looks like a camel, but it has a very long neck. Right? But the principle is, it's permissible. Right? It doesn't. There's nothing about it that the Sharia has excluded. So the principle is permissibility. Okay, now we come into the controversial issues. A man walks into a place and he finds a plate of meat. If we use the previous qa'ida, we would say it's permissible to eat it, because there's no evidence of the lack of permissibility and al-asl fi al-ashya' al-ibaha. However, many scholars, including the Hanbalis, they have another qa'ida, another principle. Al-asl fi al-ibda'i wal-luhumi wa mal al-ma'soom wa nafsuhu at-tahreem. The principle in possessions and in meats and in the inviolable wealth and in the soul is tahreem, it's not permissible. So there's a difference. The difference between this and the animal. The animal is halal in principle. Meaning if it's not mentioned in the Sharia, if it does not have claws or fangs, etc., it's in principle permissible. But you find meat that is already slaughtered, and you do not know, is it slaughtered correctly or is it not slaughtered correctly? You say the principle is tahreem, it's not permissible. Now you understand, by the way, without going into controversy, if for some reason there is a scholar who does not take this qa'idah, his conclusion is going to be different than a scholar who does take this qa'idah. You understand? Okay. Now, another example that this comes into play, in principle, it is permissible for a Muslim man to marry a Muslim woman, correct? Now, I'll give you an example. A man tells his mother, you know, our next door neighbor, they have 5 daughters. I want to marry one of these daughters. So he tells his mother, go ask them for me to marry one of the daughters, whatever, whichever one. And the mother says, you know, when those daughters were young, I breastfed one of them. And I don't remember which one of them I breastfed. I don't remember, was it Fatima, was it Zainab, but I don't know which one. But one of those girls, I breastfed them. And I don't know which one it is. Can he say to his mother, okay, well, in principle, the Muslim woman is halal. You know, in principle, all things are permissible. And al-yaqeen la yazulu bishak, you have doubt about which one you breastfed, so no problem. But the mother is knowledgeable, she came to our class, so she says, look, what you said is true. All things are permissible, and everything that you've said, except there is an exception. Al-aslu fil abda' at-tahreem, that when it comes to relationship, intimacy, the rule is impermissible. So she says, your sister, because the one she breastfed is his sister, correct? That's why he can't marry her. Your sister is hidden amongst mahsurat, a limited number of women. And I can't tell which one she is, therefore in principle you cannot marry any of them. And this is the correct position. He can't marry any of the girls. Now what if he told his mother, I want to marry a girl from Mississauga. I want to marry a Muslim girl from Mississauga. And the mother says, I breastfed once a baby girl from Mississauga. And I don't remember which one she is. Can she make all of the women of Mississauga haram for her? No, why? Because we said mahsurat in the first one, that they are limited in number. Mississauga is not really limited. It's too many thousands. So in this case, it wouldn't apply. But in the case in which someone that is not permissible for him to marry amongst a group that are limited in number, and he doesn't know which one of them he can't marry, then he can't marry any of them. Also in this principle, wealth that is ma'asoon. So for example, let's say if there's a cell phone over here and I don't know who it belongs to, can I take it and say in principle, and also fil asha' al-ibaha, like in principle things are permissible, so I'm just going to take the cell phone, it's mine now. No, we say why? Because it is wealth that belongs to a ma'asum. What is a ma'asum? So ma'asum is every Muslim is ma'asum, has a isma, they have an in, like a sanctity essentially, and every non-Muslim who has a peace treaty with the Muslims, either a peace treaty or he's a dhimmi or whatever the case is, that there's a peace between them and between the Muslims. But basically anyone who's not in a state of war against the Muslims is considered ma'asum. And so, if we see wealth, whether it belongs to a Muslim or a non-Muslim, so long as that non-Muslim is not in a state of war with the Muslims, we can't just say, well, I can take it for myself. No, in principle, this is haram, right? Same thing if somebody says, well, أَصْلَ فِي الْأَشَاءَ الْإِبَاحَ, the principle in all things is permissibility, so I'm going to go kill some people today. We say, no, because النفس ونفسه, the nafs of the ma'asum is الْأَصْلَ فِيهَا التَّحْرِيمِ, it's not permissible. Of course, the Prophet ﷺ said, إِنَّ دِمَاءَكُمْ وَأَمْوَالَكُمْ وَأَعْرَاضُكُمْ حَرَامٌ عَلَيْكُمْ كَحُرُمَةِ يَوْمِكُمْ هَذَا. Indeed, your blood and your wealth and your honor is sacred like the sacredness of this day. Okay, somebody goes to a restaurant and they hear widespread news that the chicken in this city or in this country is not slaughtered according to Islamic rules. These chickens are electrocuted. Is the meat halal or haram? He doesn't know specifically this restaurant. He's not sure. This plate of chicken, he doesn't know. But he knows in this country or in this city, it is very widespread that the chickens are electrocuted. So does he say in principle this is halal, or does he say in principle this is haram? In principle, he says this is haram. Because this qa'idah, that the asl here is tahreem. Now, let's say another issue. Brother Zain invites us all over to his house for dinner. And from his generosity, mashallah, he went and he got two lambs, slaughtered two lambs for us. And let's assume, for the sake of this argument, we are in a Muslim country when this happens. We didn't see him slaughter the lamb. We don't know where he bought it from. We don't know any of that. We come to his house and the meat is ready and it's on the plate, it's ready for you. What is the ruling here? Is the principle that it is haram, or is the principle that it is halal? It is halal. And are we required to ask him, where did you get this meat from? No, we're not required to ask him. In fact, it would be, you know, rude to ask him. Why? Because even though in principle the meat is impermissible, the man is a Muslim. Let's say he lives in an area where slaughtering the animals according to Sharia is common. It's common that the animals are slaughtered according to the Sharia. So in this case, the dhan is permissible. This is one of the areas you act upon dhan. The dhan is permissible. Even though we say in principle it's not permissible, we take the dhan over the asl. This is one of the issues where dhan goes over the yaqeen, or over the asl that we have. Yes. So we say it depends what is widespread. And it's interesting because I'm thinking about this myself. And I was thinking, you know, if I went to, I don't know, think of a small city in Ontario or something like that, or a small city in America. You go like Little Rock, Arkansas or something. I don't know. Some place where there's a small city, there's barely any Muslims there. Immediately we have to have the assumption that the meat is not halal, right? But if you're in Mississauga and you're in a Muslim's house, and halal meat is very common in Mississauga. Every grocery, Walmart has halal meat, Costco has halal meat. Then in this case, based on what the fuqaha have said, I think, this is just my thought, that in this case we would act according to this. We would not ask another Muslim where did they get their meat. Right? Allah knows best. So if I'm in a place or a city where it's very common and well known that the chickens are slaughtered Islamically, then I don't ask about it. But if I'm in a place where it's very common that they are slaughtered un-Islamically, then I can ask. It's permissible in that scenario to ask. Okay, the next point, لا عبرة بالظن البين خطأه. There is no consideration for assumptions that have been shown or proven to be wrong. Yes. No, the soul we mentioned, if you wanted to kill people, we say no, it's ma'asum, right? It's just like the wealth, you can't take it. Okay, لا عبرة بالظن البين خطأه. There's no consideration for assumptions that have been shown to be wrong. So let's say, for example, we're all sitting together, and my cell phone, the adhan goes off on it, on the cell phone. And we all get up and say, okay, it's time for Aisha to pray. And we all get up and we pray. Then after the prayer, I look at my phone, I say, you know what, something's wrong with my phone, and the adhan went off 30 minutes before it should have. And we prayed Aisha 30 minutes before the adhan for it. Is our salah valid or not? It's not valid. At the time we prayed, we prayed based on dhan, right? Because we assumed that the adhan is correct, right? Now our dhan is proven to be wrong. The dhan has been proven to be wrong. So we say, la ibra bidhan. There is no consideration for the dhan that has been proven to be wrong. Okay? And so now we have to re-pray our prayer. Exactly. It was valid until we found out it was wrong. So this is an example. This is a common example. So you go and you you come to pray and you're like, I made wudu, I don't remember if I broke my wudu or not. Right? So we already talked about this one. The person says, I stick with my yaqeen. So he stands up and he prays. Then after the prayer, he's making tasbih and he's sitting and he's thinking and he says, oh my God, actually I for sure went to the washroom. Now I remember very clearly, for sure I went to the washroom after I made wudu. So now, does he have to make up that prayer? Yes, because there's no shak anymore. Now there's yaqeen, right? There's yaqeen that has removed the previous yaqeen. So that's the other principle as well. But the assumption that we are still on our wudu has been proven to be incorrect. So now because it's proven, I have to redo the prayer. Yes? So in the Hanbali Madhab, and I believe in the Shafi'i and the Maliki as well, in that case, the Imam has to redo his prayer, but the people who prayed behind him do not have to. The Hanafis have an exception in this. And this is why I've seen before in a Hanafi masjid, the Imam put up a sign and said, whoever prayed with me Salat al-Isha on this and this a day, I realized I didn't have my wudu that day, so redo that prayer. Because the Hanafis say everybody has to redo it. But the other madhab say only the Imam has to. Once he remembers, oh, actually I didn't have my wudu, he has to redo it, but everybody else's prayer is valid. Okay. I'll give you an example, and this is also a real example. A woman was sleeping during Ramadan, the night of Ramadan. And she wakes up and she checks her clock, and the clock says 4 a.m. And Fajr at that time is 5 a.m. So she says, alhamdulillah, she gets up, she eats and she drinks, etc. And as she's eating, she hears the iqamah in the masjid. She says, how is this possible? She goes back and looks at her watch, and it's still 4 a.m. So she woke up at 4 a.m., she's eating, drinking, it's still 4 a.m. Of course, like the clock is broken, right? So the clock's not moving. So she realizes now that she ate and drank after Fajr, after the Adhan of Fajr. Okay, is she sinful? No. Because the first principle, الأصل بقاء ما كان على ما كان, things remain as they are. She woke up in the night, or she assumes it was in the night, she can stick with that principle that it's the night. And she even tried to check the time, right? She's not sinful. Does she have to make up her fast? Yes, she has to make up her fast. According to the vast majority of scholars, she has to make up her fast. Because there is no consideration for dhan that is proven to be incorrect, right? So once she knew 100% that what she assumed to be true is false, she has to redo that fast, because the fast is not valid. Now what if she woke up, she thought it's not Fajr time, she ate and she drank, and then she prayed Fajr, she had no idea that she ate after Fajr. And she continued her whole day, she has no idea about this. What is the state of her fast? It's valid.
Yeah. So that's non void, not that fast.
Yeah, once she knows that she ate after Fajr, the fast is void, she has to redo it. And but she's not sinful. So she's not sinful for it. Yes. So this is different. As you're eating, the adhan starts. No, this is no problem. Even the Prophet ﷺ told people with the food in their mouth to continue the food, to eat the food, right? It's not meant to be like this exact moment. But if it's proven that after Fajr by like 10 minutes, 20 minutes, you're still eating, no, at that point, like this is over. Not necessarily finish your plate, but what's in your mouth, you can finish it. Yeah, the scholars say what's in your mouth or right in your hand, like this, you can finish that. But if you have a huge plate, you're going to sit there for 20 minutes, no. Yeah. Okay. There are some exceptions to this. I'll give you actually two examples. Someone gives zakah to a Hashimi, someone from Banu Hashim. Are they allowed to receive zakah? They're not allowed to receive zakah. So he gives zakah to someone from Bani Hashim. Then he finds out after this person is from Bani Hashim. He has to he has to redo that zakah. So that zakah was not valid. He has to repay it. But if somebody gave zakah to someone he believes to be poor, he talks to the person says, I'm poor, I can't pay anything, I can't pay my bills, I can't pay my rent. We assume this person is poor. So we give them zakah. Then afterwards, somebody else comes to you and says, you know that person, that brother you gave him zakah money? He's lying to you, he's rich. He's got a nice car and he's living a nice life. He lies to people, this is how he makes money. This person, we tell him, your zakah is valid and you do not need to make it up. Why? The scholars say because it is difficult to ascertain someone's poverty. But it is not too difficult to ascertain whether someone is Hashimi or not. So they said if he gave it to a Hashimi, he should have known and he has to repay it. But if he gave it to somebody who lied to him, con man who lied and pretended to be poor but was actually not, then in this case, they let it go. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala knows best. Okay, let's do some quiz. So one person claims that another person hit their car or broke his hand and he does not have proof. Does the accused need to do anything more than swearing an oath that he is innocent? Does he have to pay or does he have to just swear the oath? Just swear the oath. Okay, based on what we studied, which of these principles does this come under? So is it that the principle in all things is permissibility, or the principle of the presumption of innocence, or the principle to place the event at its nearest time? Sorry? Aslu bara'a dhimma, so that he is innocent. This is the principle we're acting upon. Okay, a person has doubt whether he swore an oath to fast or not. Does he have to fast? Yes or no? No? So no, he does not have to fast because the oath has not been established. Okay, what is the principle that we used here? Is it that all things are permissible or the presumption of innocence or to place the event at the nearest time? Presumption of innocence. And if we had put al-asl fi al-umur al-arida al-adam, that the principle in the emergent issues is its non-existence, that could also apply to this as well. Okay, a capital investor claims that his partner has unclaimed profits and he has no proof and the partner rejects this claim. Whose claim should be taken, the investor or the partner or neither of them? The claim of the partner. Because the other one is making the claim, the other one has to prove it. And the principle we use here is? That's correct. Okay, he sees an impurity on his clothing and he does not know whether it occurred before or after his prayer. Does he have to redo his prayer? The impurity is established. Does he have to redo the prayer or not? So he doesn't have to do it. And because we place the event at its nearest time. So why are we placing it before the prayer? We don't know if it came dropped on him before the prayer, dropped on him after the prayer. So we put it to its nearest time. Its nearest time is when he discovers it. Does that make sense? No? Okay. then is he certain? Is it certain it happened before the prayer? And if a person prayed and he just finishes his prayer, he looks over and he sees it, he's going to be certain it happened before the prayer, because he knows during the prayer nothing fell on him. He's going to look around, nothing fell on me, right? So he's going to be certain. But if he's not certain, and he thinks it could have happened while I prayed, or it could have happened after I prayed, then he's not certain, right? We place it to its nearest time. Okay, he ate thinking that the sun has set, then it becomes clear to him that the sun did not set. Does he have to make up the fast? And what is the principle here? The last one, right? Because if he didn't discover that he was wrong, it would have been fine. But once he discovered he's for sure wrong and that he ate before Maghrib, then he has to redo the fast. Okay, he divorced one of his wives 3 times and forgets which one he divorced. This is somebody who has multiple wives. And he says, I divorced one of them. I don't know which one I divorced. And it's the 3rd time. And if it's the 1st time, we would let him go. Say it's okay, because he could take them back. But he divorced her 3 times. He's not sure which one he divorced. Is he allowed to be intimate with them? Exactly. So when it comes to intimacy, relationship, he cannot. The principle is tahrim, the principle is haram. So we say all of your wives are haram, all of the wives that you think might be divorced are haram, until you are certain which one you divorced. So he can't go to any of them. That's the last question.
The worst scenario.
I have to think of examples that we can use. Okay, inshallah. Jazakallah khair. And then next week we'll come back, inshallah, and go with the next principle, bi'idhnillah. Just like I mentioned in the beginning, we do have the fundraising dinner on Friday. I hope you guys can attend. And on Saturday, inshallah, Imam Tom is going to be here. He's going to give like a workshop on capitalism and communism and Islam. And I highly recommend, inshallah, if you guys have time to attend that, I think from 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock. So come for that, bi'idhnillah, as well. He's a very knowledgeable brother, inshallah. And I think there's a lot to benefit from him. And inshallah, Sunday we have our class as well, bi'idhnillah. Sorry? I'll try, inshallah. We were going to do, so Friday is going to be there. TCC. The Saturday event was supposed to be there. I might move it here. But we'll see, inshallah. Jazakallah khair. Subhanakallahumma bihamdika ashhadu an la ilaha illa anta astaghfiruka wa atubu ilayk.